Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President-elect Donald Trump is naming ExxonMobil chief Rex Tillerson as his Secretary of State. His choice raises concerns among many for Tillerson's close business ties with the Russian government. More broadly, some critics of Donald Trump say they're concerned that Trump is operating increasingly like the authoritarian fascist leaders in Europe after World War I. Here to talk about the issue, Julie Hirschfeld Davis of the New York Times, Stephen Moore of the Heritage Foundation, and joining us from a studio at Yale, Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale University. But first, I do want to hear reactions to President-elect Donald Trump's choice of Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. Joining us by phone for that portion of the conversation, Aaron David Miller of the Wilson Center. And a little later on in the hour, we'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And thanks to all of you for being with us.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Dan.
Hey, Dan.
Glad to be here.
Aaron David Miller, talk about Rex Tillerson and why you believe he is such a controversial choice.
You know, I think I'd quote Dorothy Lanning in Oz, basically, to say that she said to little dog Toto, we're not in Kansas anymore. And I think we really aren't in Kansas anymore. Tillerson's appointment, and I don't want to prejudge it, Tillerson's appointment breaks with pretty sharply with past precedent. I think since the end of the Second World War, we have never had a Secretary of State whose entire career was spent in the private sector without any traditional or former public service or government experience and exposure to foreign policy. That's not necessarily fatal. I mean, Exxon, in many respects, could be described as a country. It operates on five continents and 50 countries around the world. It has its own intelligence organizations reporting on developments. Tillerson clearly is a man of the world. He's been around. He certainly knows the oil business, which is a political business, not just an economic business, in Asia and the Middle East. So in many respects, the qualities that are required, at least the internationalism that is required and a sense of the world, is present. The controversy obviously comes with trying to establish where the national interest begins and ends and where Exxon's interests begin and ends. And I think that case is going to be made very clear, I'm sure, by the Secretary designate during the nomination hearings, in which he'll make a case that this is an honor and a privilege. He understands full well that this is now the national interest, the only interest that counts. Others will raise any number of issues, Exxon's policies on climate change, conflict of interest, which flow from Exxon's deal with the Kurds, which put them in the middle of a controversy with the government of Iraq. Of course, the now famous relationship with Vladimir Putin. Let me just close, John, by saying one other thing. Based on working for half a dozen secretaries of state, R's and D's, a secretary of state fails or succeeds according to three factors. Number one, does he or she have a relationship with the president? Will the president protect secretaries back in Washington and abroad? Number two, are there opportunities in the world, crises to defuse, agreements to reach that would allow a secretary of state to be consequential? And finally, the persona of that secretary. Does that secretary of state have the kind of personality and temperament that is required to negotiate and to create relationships with a broad array of countries and leaders? Those are the three factors. And I think on all of them, I suspect we're going to find out where Mr. Tillerson has strengths and weaknesses.
All right. Turning to Stephen Moore, this is clearly someone that President-elect Trump feels comfortable with.
That's right. I'm just relieved that Mitt Romney was not the choice, because I thought Mitt Romney would have been a lousy choice for a lot of reasons, and he was seriously considered for this. I don't disagree with anything that was just said. I think there are going to be, you know, issues with Rex Tillerson in terms of this issue of conflict of interest, because he did run the world's largest oil company for so many years. I got to know him a little bit, Diane, when I was at the Wall Street Journal on the editorial board. He would come in every 6 months or so, and I mean, I was incredibly impressed just with his knowledge of the world. I mean, this is a guy who does know what's happening, you know, in every corner of the globe. And just one other thing just to throw out there as a thought, you know, we started this conversation by saying, you know, that he is it breaks with precedent. And certainly it does. But I think you're going to see a lot of that with Donald Trump breaking with precedent. And I think, you know, if Donald Trump were here right now, I think he'd say, well, I want to break up the kind of foreign policy industrial complex and think anew. We saw that, by the way, with his taking the phone call with the Taiwanese minister, which was something I applauded.
Well, Julia Hirschfeld Davis, what do you think?
Well, one, I think, vital thing that that Aaron raised is this idea of having a rapport with the president, which President-elect Trump has made very clear. One of the reasons that he picked Mr. Tillerson is that he finds him to be a kindred spirit in terms of being a dealmaker, somebody who has negotiated difficult deals around the world. And in fact, in the past several weeks, as Donald Trump has been criticized for his cabinet picks, so many billionaires and millionaires, and, you know, you said you were going to be making policy for the forgotten men and women and all of the, you know, you're basically assembling this ultra-wealthy cabinet. He has said, listen, these are the sorts of people I want in my government, people who have made a fortune, people who know how to do a deal. And we know also from some of what the president-elect has chosen to do during his transition. Steve just mentioned the call with the Taiwanese leader. He is taking a very transactional approach to foreign policy and to the United States' relationship with the world. That may turn out to be a great thing. It may turn out to be not such a great thing. But it's very clear that that is the way that he views a lot of these issues. And if that's going to be the case, it does make sense that he would pick someone who he considers to be an uber deal maker, the best at that, to be his Secretary of State.
Aaron, I want to ask you about Jerry Seib's column this morning that points to areas where he says that President-elect Trump has indicated he will shift U.S. foreign policy, especially in a partnership with Russia trying to oust President Bashar al-Assad from Syria, having a warmer relationship with Egypt's president, and a policy that will be even more hostile toward Iran. Tell me about your thoughts.
You know, someone defined a realist in foreign policy as someone who prefers order before order and stability before freedom. Now, that's a rather harsh judgment, but I think what you're going to see, and I think President-elect laid it out, frankly, 2 weeks ago in a rally in Cincinnati where he announced Jim Mattis, Secretary of Defense. Nobody paid much attention to the fact that he also laid out three elements of what he described in that rally as a new foreign policy. Number one, no more overthrowing or regime change. Number two, no more foreign policy, what Michael Mandelbaum would describe as social work. We're not going to pour trillions of dollars into nation building and reconstruction in places like Iraq and Syria. And then finally, cooperating with anyone who will help us defeat ISIS. And I think the reference clearly was to Mr. Putin. The paradox here, Diane, I think is interesting, though. I suspect on these issues, the so-called transaction that Donald Trump is going to pursue, frankly, in many respects, is not that radical of departure from the transactional presidency we saw on these issues with President Obama. He was very risk-averse when it came to militarizing the American role in Syria, only responded in Iraq as a consequence of the emergence and the rise of the Islamic State. So I think in that respect, there may be, on those kinds of issues, there may be continuity. Much, much more of a contrast, however, when it comes to dealing with Putin, when it comes to dealing with Iran, And probably, almost certainly, when it comes to dealing with Benjamin Netanyahu.
You know, when you mention the nation building, I think there's been a reconsideration of foreign policy on the right, frankly, in this, you know, still post Cold War, World War II era, of what is a conservative foreign policy. And I think just having been on the campaign trail with Donald Trump, and when he talked about these issues of we're not going to be nation building, we're not going to be sending tens of billions of dollars all over the world to try to make the world safe for democracy, I think that's evolving into a more conservative foreign policy, whether it's the right one or not. But I think that is following where conservative thought is going.
Steve, talk just one few seconds about apparently Donald Trump's pick for Department of Energy.
Well, I mean, this issue of energy, I think, is going to be one of the starkest contrasts between, you know, Obama's 8 years in office and Trump's. I mean, Trump wants to develop America's oil and gas and coal resources, and he will do that. And Rick Perry is the governor of Texas. Texas is the leader of oil and gas development, so it's a pro-development pick.
Stephen Moore, senior fellow on economics at the Heritage Foundation. Short break. When we come back, we'll talk about fascism, what it is, its history, how it may relate to politics today. Stay with us.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture,
and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And welcome back. As we turn now our attention to the issue of fascism, Donald Trump is holding another victory rally today, gathering his supporters with great enthusiasm. A number of his critics are increasingly concerned his political appeal and agenda bears some similarity to last century's fascist leaders in Europe. And for that, I want to turn now to Timothy Snyder. He's professor of history at Yale University and author of a book titled Black Earth, The Holocaust as History and Warning. Timothy Snyder, help us to understand a little about what fascism is. That term is thrown around so much lately. In today's terminology, what do we mean by it?
Yeah, thank you, Diane, for posing the question that way. It's true that fascism has become a kind of term of abuse, and even sometimes people who themselves are fascists end up calling other people fascists, which can be quite confusing. It's also true that the historical phenomenon is a few generations old now. We're just past the point where people who remember the 1930s can help us to remember what fascism actually was. So I think it's important to start from the beginning. Fascism was a reaction against globalization. It was the claim that one should put one's own country and one's own people first. Fascism put a face on globalization. It said that globalization wasn't just a matter of rules or challenges, but of specific enemies, usually ethnic enemies, often arrayed in some kind of a conspiracy. Fascism said we shouldn't try to understand the world with a reason, but instead rely on faith, not faith in God, but faith in a particular leader. So fascism put emotions ahead of thoughts. It put will ahead of reasonability. Now, this is all very important because these aren't just ideas. These are people, and these are victorious election campaigns, and these are the ends of democracy. After 1918, much like after 1989, we thought, well, history has come to an end. There's no idea left besides liberal democracy. And then we saw after 1918, as we're now seeing after 1989, that this is simply not the case. fascists, their followers, by way of elections or other means, are able to overturn democracies throughout Central and Eastern Europe. And we see something like a similar pattern emerging now.
Tell me what happened after 1918 to allow for the rise of fascism.
Well, there are, I guess, three very important things to keep in mind. The first, which is really important for Americans, is that history doesn't actually have a pattern or a flow. We tend to think that once you have capitalism, you'll get democracy or vice versa or some such thing. And that's just basically nonsense. History doesn't bear that out. You need an awful lot of other conditions in place. You can't take your eye off the ball, in other words. Democracy does actually tend to degrade rather than to support itself. That's a general remark. Second thing is, what you had was obvious inequality as a result of this thing that we now call globalization. There was a Great Depression, there was trade war, there was the experience at both the local and the national level that we should be doing better than we are, which led to counterproductive elections, counterproductive trade policies. But the third thing, which is very important to keep in mind, are in fact the ideas. We've gotten ourselves convinced that ideas don't matter anymore, that all the big ideas have left the framework, which is just not the case. The idea, for example, that truth doesn't matter, the whole post-factual business that we're now getting used to, that's actually a fascist idea for the 1920s and 1930s, that one should have faith in individuals. One can ignore the facts, right? Those are old ideas. Those are the kinds of ideas which allow regimes to change. So that's another thing one should pay attention to.
Do you believe that Donald Trump falls into the category of behaving with fascist beliefs?
I find it very hard to know what the man actually believes, and I would be suspicious of anyone, you know, except perhaps his family and closest friends who would make confident claims about that. But I think that itself is precisely one reason to be concerned. The way fascism works is to deny the importance of consistency, right? And Mr. Trump is someone who has generally taken both sides of every position. One clue, and this relates back a little bit to a side of the earlier discussion, which I think maybe was undertreated. One clue is who he likes abroad, right? So the notion that a second reset of relations with Russia can be treated in narrow, you know, Washington establishment type terms like we just did, or one could consider the fact that Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin have been carrying out for the past half decade a resuscitation of far right wing and indeed sometimes fascist traditions, and have been supporting with propaganda and with money much of the European far right. If we look at the Trump-Putin relationship that way, it might then give a clue to what some of the underlying ideas are, or at least some of the direction as to where foreign policy might be going. Again, with foreign policy. Sorry, go ahead.
Let me pose then the question in another way, not so much as to beliefs, but to behaviors.
I think if you watch the rallies, if you go to the rallies and listen to the rallies, there are some patterns which are quite familiar to those of us who have watched the films or read the transcripts of rallies from the 1920s and 1930s. The first is the total hostility to facts, right? That you just most of the time say things that aren't true. The second is the kind of shamanistic incantation, which in Trump's case was build that wall and lock her up. Things which are criminal, things which we know are not actually going to happen, but which establish a kind of mystical relationship between the crowd and the person. The third is magical thinking, you know, the constant promise at the rallies that we're going to simultaneously cut taxes, pay off the national debt, increase spending on domestic policy and on defense. We all know that this is impossible, right? But we embrace it. And then finally, the final element, which is very similar to interwar fascist rallies, would be the misplaced faith, where Trump says things like, I alone can solve this, or I am your voice, which can lead people to confuse their faith in the leader with truth, or can lead people to abandon their own claim to individually discern what's actually going on. That's very similar, and that's alarming.
Timothy Snyder is professor of history at Yale University. Julia Hirschfeld Davis, you've been watching President-elect Trump and have seen what's going on, have heard what's going on, have reported on what's going on. How do you interpret Professor Snyder's comments?
Well, I have been with him a lot over the past several weeks. I was at several of these rallies last week. And the first thing I would say is that I agree completely with Tim that, you know, it's hard to know exactly what Donald Trump's core is. He's just been elected president. I think we know less about him than many presidents-elect of the recent past. We don't know how he's going to be when he gets into the Oval Office. But what I can say is it's interesting when I was listening to Tim describe the attributes of this kind of a leader. I mean, we do see a lot of these themes and hear a lot of these themes at Donald Trump's rallies. The idea of a reaction against globalization. He talks about we haven't been for our own people in the past. Now we have to be for America first, the American people first. It's going to be hire American and buy American. It's all about we haven't had a focus on you, the American people, and we're going to have that now.
But what is wrong with that to his supporters?
Nothing. There is nothing wrong with that to his supporters. And I think that is the reason, frankly, that he was able to put together the coalition that he did to win and surprised a lot of people, including himself and many of his closest aides. So, I mean, but the themes are certainly there. This idea of, you know, emotions ahead of thoughts. A lot of these rallies are very, you know, he walks out to proud to be an American, and you can really feel the sort of electricity of emotion in those rallies where people are, you know, there's a transference onto him of a lot of ideals and a lot of hopes that people feel like they have not been able to accomplish or achieve or live up to over the past several years. And globalization and trade and this idea of we're outward looking instead of inward looking in terms of our national priorities really does capture people's imagination. We do also hear a lot of contradictory statements coming from Donald Trump. You know, he has been he talked a lot in the last couple of weeks about we saw him tweet about millions of illegal votes, that he would have won the popular vote were it not for millions of illegal votes. There was no foundation for that claim. There's been no proof of that claim. He then said this week, also on Twitter, I believe, that, you know, he had the largest electoral college victory in history. Not even close. These are things that he says by way of effect, and people sort of write off. They say, oh, it's details, you know, it's not, he didn't really mean that. And there was much made during at the end of the campaign of Donald Trump's supporters took him seriously, but not literally. The rest of the country who questioned him, including the press, took him literally, but not seriously. And so I think there is really this whole question of what is the place of facts? And he very effectively, with his 17 million Twitter followers, raises all sorts of questions about what is really true and if the press is out to get him if they report otherwise.
Julie Hirschfeld Davis, White House reporter for The New York Times. Stephen Moore, tell me your reactions to the discussion of fascism, its association with Donald Trump.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I wrote a column on this issue of fascism about a year ago when people first started saying that Donald Trump had fascistic tendencies. There were a lot of articles about that a year ago. And I started looking at just the history of the meaning of the word fascism. And what's interesting that has evolved, if you look at the definition, say, 50 years ago versus today, 50 years ago, it just meant a ruler who had a demagogic rhetoric and that wanted to use the power of the state to control people's lives. Now, if you read the more modern definition of fascism, it means a right-wing, you know, dictator that wants to pursue these policies, as if you can't have a left-wing fascist. And the reason I don't like that term fascist anymore is because it tends to mean, to people on the left, it just means someone on the right who they don't agree with. And so a couple of things. I mean, you know, for example, when the professor was talking about the rallies that Trump is at, I've attended a lot of those, as you have. I met some amazingly, you know, incredibly patriotic Americans. And I think, frankly, it's a little insulting to say that Trump is a fascist when he holds these rallies, because I think it's insulting to the people, the millions and millions of people who attended these rallies. But the other thing I was thinking about, and I'd love the professor's reaction to this, is look at Barack Obama. I mean, some of the rallies that he had in 2008 with the Gothic columns, and he would come out as if he was the Messiah. Was that fascistic?
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. How do you respond to that, Professor Snyder?
Well, first of all, I think it's very important for us to take history seriously, and rather than focus on what fascism means to you and to me, to remember that fascism was actually a thing in the world which brought about tens of millions of deaths and a Second World War and a Holocaust. It was something, to move to the question of whether, you know, one is insulting one's fellow Americans or not, it was something that appealed to patriotic Italians, patriotic Romanians, patriotic Germans, and in the 20s and 30s, also many patriotic Americans. That is precisely the problem. We can't get away from the problem by saying we're insulting this or we're insulting that. The whole point is that history is one flow, that things that happen in the past teach us about what's possible in the present and in the future. So we have to be alert to this precisely because we are vulnerable to it. And in that sense, I agree.
Well, how much, Tim Snyder, of what is happening would you attribute to simply the way the country is moving or to Donald Trump himself?
He maps on very well the things that are happening in the country. We do have a problem with globalization. Globalization creates the appearance and the reality of inequality. It creates the appearance and the reality of problems of social advance. People are vulnerable to the claim, especially when the state doesn't do its job, that globalization has a face, that face is Chinese or Mexican or Jewish or Muslim, rather than globalization being a condition. That's a real problem. There are two ways to address it. The first way is to try to get better rules and have a more functional state. The second way is to look for enemies. We know from history which way both of those things go. But secondly, Donald Trump is undeniably a talented rhetorician. He's undeniably a good speaker. He undeniably understands the way that technology works. I mean, in many ways, he's like a 25-year-old rather than a 70-year-old, because he uses technology to get through, to get by, to get over the normal conventions about what's true, right? And that, I have to say, is extremely important. And it's something that I think conservatives in particular should be alert to. The indifference to facts or the attempt to create a new reality isn't just some kind of detail. That's the core of the whole project. You substitute faith in yourself. You substitute the regularity of your own address to the people for the kinds of truths that people on the right, people on the left, normal people, people who vote one way, people another way, can agree on. When we get to a world where the fiction trumps the fact, we've taken a big step towards fascism, not towards conservatism. That's something completely different, but towards fascism. This whole post-factuality business, I think, is pre-fascist.
Steve?
So, look, I think the most important, of course, fascism was one of the most horrific events of human history, no question about it. And the 20th century was clearly one of the bloodiest centuries ever. And it was all, see, I see all these isms, whether it's fascism, communism, Stalinism, socialism, they're all basically the same. They are the bringing together of massive power within political leaders who've used that power to create great acts of murder and genocide. The point is, you know, people on the left talk about Hitler, but the same people on the left, you know, if you go back to the 1950s, look at the people in Hollywood who apologized for Stalin, who apologized for Castro, who apologized for, Mao, who were great tyranny too. And my point is, when you centralize government power, that's what leads to fascism.
Stephen Mora of the Heritage Foundation. Short break here, and when we come back, more of our discussion, your calls, your comments. Stay with us. And welcome back. As we talk about both the history and present-day outlook on the question of fascism, a word that's been tossed around a great deal. Certainly, Steve Moore, who's here in the studio, wrote about it a year ago. Then we had Michael Kinsley writing about it in the Washington Post. We had John McNeil writing about it in the Washington Post and grading, indeed, Donald Trump on the what he called the 11 attributes of fascism. Julie, many people have complained there's a real risk now of normalizing Donald Trump's behavior. How have you, as a journalist, approached this?
Well, it's a difficult challenge, right? Because he is now the president-elect. There's a certain amount of stock and respect and sort of seriousness with which you have to take any utterance of the president-elect, in this case, including his many posts on Twitter. We've been criticized in the media for writing stories when Donald Trump tweets something. Well, the fact is that is his means of communication with 17 million people. That is, in a lot of ways, the clearest distillation of what he's thinking and feeling about a given policy issue, a personnel decision. And we know that one of the things that has characterized Donald Trump's transition since he won is he has a very tight inner circle, and a lot of the time they don't exactly know what he's thinking. He's very much, he sort of has consolidated a lot of these decisions and a lot of the power of the, you know, pre-presidency to himself. So you have to sort of, I think as journalists, one of the ways that we've tried to approach this is real-time fact-checking. We always try to fact check. And anyone who we are interviewing, anyone who, you know, makes a statement about policy, is characterizing a decision by the government, we always try to fact check. But with Donald Trump, it has to be a lot more quick and a lot more thorough because he is tweeting in real time. Mm-hmm. And some of these things, as I've mentioned before, are on their face not true. Some of them are open to interpretation. What he has said about climate change, for instance, there's a vibrant debate about climate change. But when he utters, you know, when he makes an utterance about climate change and the realities of science and the environment, that demands more than just us reporting the president-elect said X.
The president-elect called climate change a hoax.
He has also then said in a subsequent interview, and this is an example of what I said earlier, that he's been on both sides of many issues. He sat down with the New York Times reporters and columnists a couple of weeks ago and said he was open on the issue. So you don't really know where Donald Trump stands on this. And frankly, I think that is how he wants it, because he is not president yet and he wants a lot of latitude to figure out what's possible, what's not possible politically and practically.
So how does that fit in, Tim Snyder, with the idea of what a president-elect says that is confusing in the end, that you really don't know exactly what he believes or what he stands for?
Mm-hmm. First of all, I want to agree with Steve that Stalinism is also a bad thing. I made my career on that claim, mm-hmm. So I want to try to find some common ground. The reason why this question, Diane, is so interesting is that it calls us back to what I think the really important question is not the analogy with fascism, not the comparison with fascism, not the term, but what we learned from it. And what we learned from the history of fascism is how democracies die. Right. And one thing which Hitler, just to take that example, was in fact very good at was communicating in one way to his followers in a way they understood and in a different way to the political establishment. And thereby, if you look at the end of 1932 and the beginning of 1933, when he came to power, in this respect, it actually was very similar. I mean, just to be very clear, I'm not saying that they're the same person or I'm not making a metaphor. Mm-hmm. But in this respect, there was a similarity. You had a politician who intended to undo a system, but who was able to placate or at least confuse enough of the establishment that this normalization business went on until it was impossible. And I think that's really the important invitation. I think this is what Americans should be thinking about and don't. The question of how democracies die, what it looks like when a figure comes to power who we don't know. I agree, we don't know. But a figure who may be an anti-systemic figure, what are the things that happen next? The history of the 20s and 30s gives you landmarks. One of them is this kind of confusion. Another is a disaster which happens, which then leads to a state of emergency. So, you know, these are things which, if we know history, we can watch out for without panicking, without saying it's all the same thing.
So can I ask you a quick question? Would you say that Castro was a fascist? Would you say that Hugo Chavez was a fascist?
No, of course not, because not everything objectionable is fascist, right? Fascism is one of many bad things in the world. If Donald Trump had a disciplined far left-wing party which ran an underground newspaper and talked about Bolshevism, we'd now be talking about other things. But he doesn't. The closer historical resemblance is with right-wing populism and fascism. That's why we're talking about fascism. There are many bad things in the world. Some of them are more relevant to this discussion than others.
I Castro was a charismatic leader. He said he could accomplish things. He suppressed and violated human rights and murdered people. Why is somehow a left-wing dictator somehow superior to someone on the right? That's sort of what I don't get about this debate, that somehow if you're on the left and you murder people, that's okay. But if you're on the right, the point I'm making is I think a lot of people who call Trump a fascist are just people who don't agree with his ideas.
Right, but that's not what we're talking about. Yeah. We're talking about something else, which is the danger to the republic that we share, right? We're not talking about name-calling. And the interesting thing about fascism is that as a historical phenomenon, it's precisely neither right nor left. The claim that fascism makes is that it's beyond all of that, which is, by the way, another similarity to our present situation. Fascism is not something that can be dismissed from history just by saying that left-wing people call other people fascists. Fascism is something that happened to people who are very similar to you and me. That's why we have to be concerned.
I agree. I mean, I think one lesson I've learned from American history is that, you know, when you have very popular leaders, and let's take Franklin Roosevelt, remember the incident where he tried to pack the court. And the American people said, even though Franklin Roosevelt was a very popular president, people said, no, you know, we believe in freedom. We believe in the separation of powers. I have a kind of fundamental faith in the American people that if Donald Trump does overstep his responsibilities and his obligation as president, I think the American people would rise up in objection to that. I really do. I think we have freedom in our DNA. We're not the Germans. So I'm not as worried about this as the professor is.
I think that conservatives in particular, people who care about history, should be raising examples, as you just have done, about the 1930s. The example of FDR packing the courts is one minor example of something that went wrong in the 1930s. If one looks a bit more broadly in the U.S. and the world, one sees lots of other examples. And I think it's precisely conservatives, the people who care about tradition, who have the responsibility for going back to the 1930s and being very sure that our institutions are not under threat.
I think it's
say,
a fair point.
I haven't seen that effort on the right thus far. I'm still waiting for that.
All right. I'm going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Jim in Canton, Ohio. You're on the air.
Yes, it's important to know historically that fascism arose in response to communism at the end of the First World War, when Germany in particular lost the war, and they had to have a scapegoat to blame. And Hitler divided his German society and most of Europe into categories of people, Jews being, of course, his primary objective, but he hated the Jews not for racial reasons or religious, but because he saw them as politically affiliated with Bolshevism, with communism, and they had to be eradicated. The basic belief being that might makes right, and that the way to improve your society and the world at large is to exterminate that category of people, the subclass. And in modern times, we see the same kind of thinking, whereas Hitler talked about illegal inferior races. We talk about illegal aliens like the Mexicans or the Muslims or these subclasses of people who, if our society would be better off if we could just get rid of them.
What do you think, Stephen?
Wow, that's a tough one. Look, I think that I don't always agree with. Look, I don't always agree with a lot of the things that Donald Trump says. I agree with many of the things, and I disagree with others. And I think it's our responsibility as conservatives to make sure that Donald Trump stays true to conservative principles of limited government. And I think the one thing I would say is the best check against the rise of fascism in this country or anywhere is to limit the size and power of government and decentralize government. When you have that kind of system, then it's much harder for political leaders to wreak the kind of havoc that they have around the world.
Tim Snyder.
The general point that the gentleman makes is one which it does apply to the past and the present, and that is, do you deal with globalization by facing up to it, or do you deal with globalization by claiming that it has a face? Hitler was an extreme example of giving globalization a face. He said that the Jews are responsible for all of the evils, including communism, that the globe brings. That's one pattern of politics. It takes more or less extreme forms. We should know that it works and how it works. As for limited government and fascism, I think the relationship's a little bit more complicated. Fascism arises partly when people are affected by inequality and are looking for some reason and can't quite grasp it. I tend to think it makes sense, and one can disagree about the range of this. I tend to think it makes sense to have a government which gives people a sense that they have a future, and therefore makes them less likely to fall for this kind of anti-globalization rhetoric.
Timothy,
and if we're talking about limited
Snyder,
government on the right, sorry, go ahead.
I'm going to interrupt you right there. Timothy Snyder is professor of history at Yale University, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have an email from Anne who says, fascism evolves in a population when leaders are able to convince their people that social inequalities are the result of immigration, globalization, feminism, and liberal education, but not the result of social and financial policies that have left a majority of the people behind. Stephen.
I don't agree with that. I think, fascism. Look, I was on the campaign trail with Donald Trump. There is no question there is an economic unease out there in this country. And, when I went to Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, the Midwestern states, they do feel that government hasn't been responsive to their economic anxieties and their concerns. And I think part of it, the Trump phenomenon, was economic. Part of it was cultural, frankly. Look, this happened in 2008 with the rise of Obama, and I think it happened in 2016 with the rise of Donald Trump. And I don't really see the fundamental differences except for the fact that one wants to move to the right and the other wanted to move to the left.
Tim Snyder.
I'm going to take a slightly broader take on this. We have the lesson of the 20th century. The lesson of the 20th century says when you get into global capitalism brings wealth, but global capitalism also brings inequality and lots of challenges. Because people feel inequality subjectively, objectively, you get extreme reactions. As Stephen says, both fascism and communism. The repair job that we did in the second half of the 20th century was to remember that if we want to have capitalism that doesn't radicalize people, we also have a state, has to have a state, which gives people a sense that they and their families have a future. That's a kind of bare minimum. We learned that lesson as an answer both to communism and to fascism. I think it's a lesson worth remembering.
And Stephen, finally, do you agree, something Julie was talking about earlier, do you agree that Donald Trump has played a major part in the flood of disinformation that has seemingly now made all information suspect?
Julie is the media person here. I'd like to have her answer to that question. I mean, you do have a situation now where people on the right get their information from news outlets on the right. People on the left get their information from news outlets on the left. And I'm not so sure that's a healthy thing, but I think it's clearly happening.
Well, and I think we have to be careful that we don't attribute all of that to Donald Trump, right? I mean, President Obama has been a master at using Facebook and Twitter and Medium to go around the press and to sort of put his own narrative out there. The big difference, though, is that, A, he does not say things that are demonstrably false repeatedly. B, and when he does, frankly, we call him on it, but it doesn't happen very often. He's very careful, sometimes to a fault, and those of us who have covered him have sometimes bristled against how disciplined they've been. But secondly, he does not turn around and criticize or question the very foundations of a free press. He comes to news conferences, President Obama does. He will challenge your premise. But what we see is Donald Trump saying, you know, they've not been nice to me. They've been rough on me. And he's not talking about editorial pages here. He's talking about the news pages and the fact that he does not feel that he's been treated nicely by news reporters. That is not the responsibility of a free and independent press in a democracy. The responsibility of a free and independent press in a democracy is to report the news and to report the facts and to hold leaders to account for them.
Tim Snyder, last word on news and the president-elect.
I think we're seeing a realignment in politics as we see changes in forms of communication. I'm not so sure that right and left are the right way to describe it. I think the better way to describe it is factual and post-factual. I find myself in huge sympathy for conservatives who care about truth, just like the anti-communist dissenters who are my friends and models cared about truth. I think in the next few years, that really is going to be the major divide. And I think it's interesting and concerning, given the history of fascism, that we're going to have a president who's on the wrong side of that divide.
Timothy Snyder. He's professor of history at Yale University, author of Black Earth, The Holocaust as History and Warning. Stephen Moore is senior fellow on economics at the Heritage Foundation and senior economic advisor to the Trump campaign. Julie Hirschfeld Davis is White House reporter for the New York Times. Thank you all.
Thank you, Ben.
So much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Baker, Denise Couture, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Alexandra Boti, Danielle Knight, Erica R. Hendry, and Allison Brody. The engineer is Alex Drewenskus. Danielle Brown answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.